This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. A defensive U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday called the U.S. airlift to extract more than 120,000 Americans, Afghans, and other allies from Afghanistan to end a 20-year war an extraordinary success, though more than 100 Americans and thousands of others were left behind. Biden says his administration started asking Americans to leave Afghanistan well before this month's evacuation.
Since March, we reached out 19 times to Americans in Afghanistan with multiple warnings and offers to help them leave Afghanistan, all the way back as far as March.
And he added the choice was to leave Afghanistan or escalate a war that already lasted a decade too long.
I was not going to extend this forever war. And I was not extending a forever exit.
Meanwhile, Pakistan's foreign minister is urging the international community to act to prevent hardship in neighboring Afghanistan after the takeover of the country by the Taliban. AP correspondent Charles Ledesma.
Shah Mahmood Qureshi says it's in the interest of peace and stability for the world to remain engaged and not abandon Afghanistan, since more instability and a further exodus of Afghans fleeing the Taliban rule were not in the interest of the nation or elsewhere, Qureshi says. As this is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history, the international community must remain engaged and should not let economic collapse take place in Afghanistan. Qureshi adds Pakistan has facilitated the evacuation of more than 10,000 foreigners from the country since the takeover. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
More at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Hundreds of thousands of Louisianans sweltered in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida Tuesday, with no electricity, no tap water, precious little gasoline, and no clear idea when things might improve. The long lines that wrapped around the block formed the new gas stations, or few gas stations, that had fuel and generator power to pump it. People cleared rotting food out of refrigerators, neighbors shared generators, and borrowed buckets of swimming pool water to bathe or to flush their toilets. The COVID-19 surge is stretching oxygen supplies and sending hospitals scrambling for more ventilators, even as there are signs of hope that the spread of the virus is starting to slow down in pockets in the United States. The oxygen shortages are yet another sign of the toll that the summer COVID-19 resurgence has taken on the nation's hospital system. A handful of states, including Florida, Oregon, Hawaii, Mississippi, and Louisiana, have set pandemic records for the number of COVID-19 hospitalizations, and many hospitals are dangerously short of staff and intensive care unit beds. There is some good news. The country is averaging 155,000 new infections a day, but the caseload's trajectory has slowed down dramatically from earlier in August. South African scientists have detected a new coronavirus variant with multiple mutations, but are yet to establish whether it's more contagious or able to overcome the immunity provided by vaccines or prior infections. The new variant, known as C.1.2, was first detected in May and has now spread to most South African provinces and to seven other countries in Africa, Europe, Asia, and Oceania, according to research which is yet to be peer-reviewed. The variant contains many mutations associated in other variants with increased transmissibility and reduced sensibility to neutralizing antibodies, but they occur in a different mix, and scientists are not yet sure how they affect the behavior of the virus. Laboratory tests are underway to establish how well the variant is neutralized by antibodies. Ukraine's president is visiting the United States in hopes of bolstering security ties in Washington and persuading the administration to ramp up sanctions against a new Russian pipeline bypassing his country. President Volodymyr Zelensky has called the U.S. failure to block the construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany a grave political error. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, September 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. More than 48,000 people are confirmed missing across Africa.
Looking at our figures, we can summarize that almost half of the missing persons that have been recorded are underage. Most of them, the majority, are men. And among the women that are searched by the families, we can see that the majority are minor.
Who is killing old people in Uganda's Masaka sub-region? In Ghana, a call to create a mixed model of election management bodies. And Tanzania's opposition leader, Freeman Mbowe, appeared in court yesterday, Tuesday.
After being arraigned today at the High Court Economic Sabotage Division, Mbowe's lawyer, they have raised an objection saying that the High Court Economic Sabotage Division has no jurisdiction to conduct such kind of cases.
And the U.S. Embassy in Liberia criticizes electricity theft in the country. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The International Committee of the Red Cross says more than 48,000 people are missing across Africa and at least 21,600 are minors. Most of the registered disappearances widely believed to be a fraction of the continent's wider undocumented humanitarian tragedy are linked to armed conflict, violence, disasters, and migration across Africa. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the number of people coming forward to report missing persons is on the rise in Africa. Amaya Fernandez, the humanitarian organization's advisor on the missing and their families for Western Africa, says the cause of the increasing numbers is twofold.
On one hand, due to the fact that we are trying to register more and more systematically cases of missing persons throughout the region, but also and certainly due to the significant increase of violence and conflict experienced in the continent, which increase at the same time the likelihood of people going missing. Looking at our figures, we can summarize that almost half of the missing persons that have been recorded are underage. Most of them, the majority, are men. And among the women that are searched by their families, we can see that the majority are minors.
The ICRC finding shows that 39,360 of the 48,000 missing people are from seven countries with armed conflicts. According to the Stockholm International Peace and Research Institute, 20 countries in Africa have armed conflict. Out of the 20, 10 are witnessing high-intensity armed conflicts. Fernandez says the ongoing conflict in some African countries has created more pain and suffering for families of missing persons.
Humanitarian consequences, particularly caused by protracted armed conflicts, are often aggravated, and these is reflected in most of the interviews. For instance, half of the families that were interviewed in Nigeria reported that their relatives had gone missing in 2014-2015. In South Sudan, majority also the families were looking for people that went missing between 2013 and 16. In Libya, families reported that they were looking for missing relatives since the late 70s until the present day. And the same goes for families in Ethiopia and Uganda.
Some experts see the need to train community workers and security agencies on the importance of information sharing to help locate missing persons. Zimbabwe's Assistant Police Commissioner, Crispin Leifer, says his country and the region need a data management system to follow up on the missing person cases.
There is need to have a database which should be continuously updated so that all missing persons and even those that are deceased, the information is captured in a database by police stations, and at the end of the day, that information has to be put in one place, and in this case, at the NCB, where maybe if you want to check across the country the number of missing persons, we'll quickly get that information from a central point.
Fauzia Hussein's brother went missing in June after a Kenyan court released him. The 39-year-old was accused of terrorism-related issues, but the court found him innocent and ordered the police to release him. His sister, Fauzia Hussein, says they never saw him again.
I know that they still have him because at every point my brother got a chance to make a phone call, he called my mother. So if he was released, why would he call my mom? So I know for a fact that they did not release him.
According to Hussein, police told her they released her brother. The ICRC calls on African governments to prevent disappearances and help with search and identification and addressing families' needs. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Uganda police have arrested 15 people suspected of involvement in serial killings in the southern part of the country. President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni has vowed that his government will arrest all of those involved. Reporter Mugumi Davis-Rakariji has more from Kampala.
Uganda police spokesman Fred Enanga confirmed in a press briefing on Monday that at least 25 people had been brutally murdered since July in what is known as Greater Massacre in the southern part of the country. Enanga said the machete-wielding killers used vicious ways to kill the victims. He said the arrested suspects have provided information that will help the police to arrest others still at large.
They have been attacking elderly persons who are staying alone and other vulnerable people who are found along the road during late hours. For now, we don't want to come up with a clear motivation, but they have their unique motives or reasons where they would kill the victims without stealing from them or committing any other offense.
Enanga said police are working with other security agencies, including National Army, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, to ensure the security of people and properties. Uganda government spokesperson Chris Vadiomons told journalists during a news conference yesterday, Tuesday, that the murders are politically motivated.
They are being used by some people, some politicians, to create fear in the population, because one of the greatest achievements of NRM government has been peace and stability, and they think that if they can hire those goons to kill people and make people restless, maybe it will appear as if the NRM government is failing to protect the population.
NRM stands for National Resistance Movement, Uganda's ruling party, which has been in power for nearly four decades. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, while presiding at a graduation ceremony for prison officers yesterday, Tuesday, also said his government will not fail to protect citizens.
It's unfortunate that they have caused the death of these old people, but those groups are finished politically, because once we bring evidence in court and say so and so is the one who sent these young people on marijuana to kill an old man of 80, where will you be? Where will you go? You have nowhere to go. You are finished. I normally say pigs. But you see what they don't realize. There is no way you can commit a crime in Uganda and we fail to know you.
The Uganda government says it will give 10 million Uganda shillings, or about $2,800 to each victim's families. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The leader of Tanzania's opposition Chadema party, Frema Umboi, appeared in court yesterday for alleged crimes of economic sabotage, conspiracy, and financing terrorist activities. Umboi and other party leaders were arrested in July this year in Mwanza as the party was preparing to hold a conference to demand constitutional reforms. The government said they conspired to destroy several gas stations across the country. Neville Mina is secretary for the Tanzania Editors Forum. It says Mboy's lawyers motioned that the High Court's Economic Sabotage Division has no mandate to hear the case and therefore asked for Mboy to be released.
It is true that Mboy has been arraigned to the High Court Economic Sabotage Division following the accomplishment of initial investigation, which was conducted or supervised under the Kisutu resident magistrate. It is normal procedures in legal system in Tanzania that the nature of the crimes or the nature of the counts which Mr. Mbowe and his colleagues are facing, that they start investigation starts at the lower court, and after completion the part of it, especially mobilizing the evidences and they have some witnesses ready, the trial shifted from lower court to the high court. That's where we are. But after being arraigned today at the High Court Economic Sabotage Division, Mbowe's lawyer, or can say the defense lawyers, they have raised an objection saying that the High Court Economic Sabotage Division has no jurisdiction or has no mandate to oversee or to conduct such kind of cases, because they say the major issue or the major charges against Mbowe and his colleagues are of terrorism, kind of. And this means that the Economic Sabotage Division of the High Court has no mandate to handle it. So they have pled that Mbowe should be released until further notice.
Last week, prosecutors told the magistrate court about their possible witnesses during the trial. Now we hear that Mbowe's lawyers have indicated they will call the Inspector General of Police as defense witness. If this happens, what will be the significance or the purpose of this?
This is very interesting, Jim, that the defense lawyers have said that they will bring the Inspector General of Police and the former district commissioner of High, Lengai Olisabaya, as their witness, defense witnesses. You never know, but this is a tricky gymnastics, especially in the trial, especially this the case of this kind of nature, especially when the big bosses are involved, like the prominent people like Mbowe are involved. They might have scheming something, and it's very tricky, and you never know. That by bringing the IGP and the former DC and being cross-examined at the court, they might shift the position of the case, because we need to know actually what will inspire. Time the best teller. Let us wait for the time and we'll see what will come out of these two important witnesses, especially the Inspector General of Police.
Neville, who is attending the trial? I mean, there was a report that the government had warned foreign diplomats not to attend the trial due to COVID-19. Is this the case?
Yes. It was last or 2 weeks ago when the government, through the minister responsible for foreign matters, released that says it like a warning to the foreign diplomats who used to go at the Kisutu magistrate when Mbowe was arraigned over there. Yes, the statement was centered on COVID-19 issues, but maybe in real sense it was not, because it's not a normal thing to see the diplomats going to the court, especially to attend such kind of cases. It was a sign that the international community is watching what is going on.
Neville Mina is Secretary for Tanzanian Editors Forum. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 1st. In Ghana, a civil society group is calling for a constitutional amendment that will create a mixed model of election management bodies. The proposal will seek to divide the Electoral Commission into two independent election management entities. Care for Free and Fair Elections, Care Ghana, said its proposal will empower the electoral body to solely concentrate on its core constitutional mandate, which is to organize and administer credible elections, while the other group carries out the other duties. David Kumi Ado, executive director of Care Ghana, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the current electoral commission appears ineffective to carry out all of its constitutional duties.
This new proposal calls on key stakeholders, government, the Electoral Commission, civil society organizations, the faith-based organizations, to re-look at a model of electoral management in this country, because we feel that the model we are using today is actually not helping because it has overlived its usefulness. And therefore, this is not actually helping. For instance, the Electoral Commission is supposed to ensure that all political parties registered have presence or are functional in two-thirds of the 260 districts in Ghana. But the Electoral Commission is unable to ensure that this particular function works. That is why we are calling that the mixed model electoral management, the mixed electoral management model should be one that should be considered so we can have proper management of our elections in this country.
But David, some people are saying if it's not broken, don't fix it. The Electoral Commission had been managing and administrating elections since 1992, and both local and international poll observers will tell you that the elections have been free, fair, transparent, and credible in spite of challenges of the outcome of the election. So the Electoral Commission appears to be perfecting its act as the years go by, and that trying to reinvent the wheel could actually create chaos. How do you respond to that?
I'll be very shocked anyone that will say that the Electoral Commission is performing very well. The fact that a lot of us, or maybe we are continuing to enjoy peace in this country, does not necessarily mean that some parts of our electoral system is not broken. There are many parts that is broken, but Ghanaians are peace-loving people. That is why we continue to endure the Electoral Commission. I'll give you some few examples. Now, one of the functions of the Electoral Commission is boundary delimitation. As we speak today, there is a community in the Volta region that has no representation in parliament. And this is very challenging. It is because of these malfunctioning that we are talking about. The Electoral Commission has been unable to perform all these functions very well.
With the proposal from your organization, what is the intended objective?
This proposal is intended to consolidate Ghana's electoral democracy. It is to help us have quality elections that people will have confidence in the outcome. A lot of people, because of the gaps that are created, believe that the 2020 elections, the winner was not the actual reflection of what the voters said. People believe that the Electoral Commission is the one that chose the president for this country, but not the voters, because of the many things that occurred in this particular elections. A lot of unprecedented things occurred. For instance, 8 people lost their lives. This has never happened in our elections before.
But David, why wouldn't the Electoral Commission be empowered to hire more people, to have a bigger employee base in order to undertake all the suggestions you are making instead of creating a different body?
So the Electoral Commission is not impeded in doing anything. It is just that the Electoral Commission is unable to perform all the functions under which it has been established. That is why we are calling for another independent body to help in this particular regard, because we are much concerned about the safety of our democracy, the peace we are enjoying today. The 2 elections in 8 years ended up at the Supreme Court. Now, we don't want our elections to be going in that particular direction. Supreme Court is the final arbiter in any electoral dispute. Now, if the people disagree with the Supreme Court, we will be heading towards chaos. We don't want to get there. We want the Electoral Commission to focus on its core functions so that it will be able to organize elections, very quality elections in this country, for people to have trust and confidence in the final declaration of results for the safety of our peace and tranquility.
That was David Kumi Ado, Executive Director of CARE Ghana. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Accra. The U.S. Embassy in Liberia last week expressed a disappointment in the Liberian government for mismanaging U.S. investment in Liberia's power sector. As Rita Jolabwe reports from Monrovia, Ambassador Michael McCarthy says the Liberia Electricity Corporation, LEC, has lost over $200 million in the last 5 years.
In January this year, the Liberian government and officials of the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia celebrated the end of the Meridian Challenge Corporation Compact, or U.S.-funded $257 million five-year project aimed at rehabilitating the Mankofi Hydro Plant, which is the largest source of electricity in Liberia. On Thursday last week, U.S. Ambassador to Liberia Michael McCarthy toured one of the facilities of the Liberia Electricity Corporation, LEC, at Bourgeois Atlin outside Monrovia to know the status of U.S. investment in Liberia's power sector. Ambassador McCarthy said at a news conference following the tour that he was disappointed in what he termed well-organized power theft cartel in Liberia.
I asked the Liberian government and the people to take power theft more seriously. Having invested so heavily in the power sector here, it's not too much for the U.S. government to ask that the Liberian government do more to protect our investments and its own power sector. The LEC has lost $220 million in the last 5 years alone to technical and commercial losses and unpaid bills. That is money that could have been spent increasing the grid to provide electricity access for all.
Ambassador McCarthy says the U.S. Embassy has been reliably informed that some top security officials have been interfering with power theft investigation.
We've been told by multiple sources that there is a well-organized electricity theft cartel that benefits well-connected businesses and even government officials. We know that some LEC investigators trying to fix this problem have been harassed by some representing themselves as security officials. This is absolutely unacceptable. As major investors in Liberia's power sector, we call on government officials to do everything possible to stop this corruption and prosecute the perpetrators, no matter how important they may be.
Pascal Buckley is the chief executive officer of the Liberia Electricity Corporation. He says the LEC is a government-owned institution, but not financed by the government. Buckley says LEC operates on revenues generated from the sales of electricity and that power theft is a serious issue affecting the corporation.
Power theft at the scale that's going on in Liberia is at an epidemic level. So whereas power theft is actually costing around $40 million. So it's still a major hill to climb for us as a business. But we have a multifaceted approach to tackling power theft.
On social media, some Liberians attribute power theft to the partial distribution of electricity in some areas. But Buckley says the LEC has designed a plan to ensure 100% distribution of electricity to areas that have access to the LEC. While others blame the issue of power theft on the inability of LEC to supply electricity to many residents, some say power theft is on the increase because LEC employees are underpaid. Lucene Ja, a resident of Monrovia, says illegal electrical connections are often facilitated by LEC employees. Ja says the Liberian government should pay LEC employees well, while at the same time instituting stringent measures against power theft.
I got my family to keep up to. They are working in a month and then $125. And so you notice the guys resign from the LEC job and they see guys who say, okay, but they said they have already been one transformer and planted a year. I got all my tools. I can distribute current and live on it.
To discourage electricity or power theft in the country, the Liberian legislature passed the Power Theft Act in 2019. The law classified power theft as a national security threat and prescribed penalties against perpetrators. But the government has yet to prosecute anyone despite the surge in power theft. Rita Jrabwe for VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, says the Biden-Harris administration has made advancing racial justice and equity a priority, including through its work at the United Nations. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield says the administration has raised the dialogue on racism and acknowledged racial discrimination as an issue endemic to every society. And that's it for this Wednesday, September 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a great day.